2023, a year of war, new and ongoing conflicts in Eastern Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, amid geopolitical tensions and a push for a new world order. This week, we'll look back at the year that saw democracy under threat, protests over the rising costs of living, and a deepening climate crisis. We'll also look at the people and the politics likely to shape 2024. Straight Talk Africa starts now. Hello there and welcome to this first edition of Straight Talk Africa for 2024. We're coming to you from VOA's headquarters in Washington. I'm Heidi Adams. It is such a pleasure to be with you. 2023 was a tumultuous year, if you ask me at least, a year in which wars and coups changed relationships between Western and African nations. In some places, hotly contested elections led to new chapters. In other places, not so much. In African countries and other parts of the world, citizens took to the streets to call for peace and demand action on the rising cost of living and the climate crisis. In the next half hour, we'll look back at the people, the politics, and the events that impacted the African continent, and we'll look at the stories likely to dominate the headlines in 2024. And joining me here in studio are Johanna LeBlanc. She's a legal and foreign policy analyst and a partner at the Washington-based Adomi Advisory Group. Also with us is Michael Walsh. He's a political commentator and a senior fellow in the Africa program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And joining us via Skype from Johanna, South Africa, is David Monda. He's a political analyst and professor of politics at City University of New York. Happy New Year and a warm welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining me here on Straight Talk Africa. We have a lot to get through in the next half hour. So, Professor David Monda, just because you are in Johannesburg, I'm going to kick things off here with you. Professor, when we look back at just sort of the continental politics in 2023, it seems as though everything was about power. That's the way I see it, at least. Who grabbed power, who held on to it, who was willing to give it up, and who was willing to hand it over, and peacefully. Elections, of course, took center stage in 2023, as they almost always do, starting early in the year in West Africa and Bola Tinubu's victory in Nigeria. Now, just looking at some of the other major elections, a second term for Emmerson Mnangagwa in Zimbabwe. He says 2024, by the way, is the year that his country's economy will turn around. And also the recent elections in the DRC with Felix Tshisekedi declared the winner of the December presidential election, giving him a second term. Now, he has vowed to make his country, quote, the Germany of Africa. Now, Professor, these were all hotly contested elections. There was deep dissatisfaction in opposition quarters about how they turned out. They were challenged on the streets and in the courts in some cases. What stood out to you about these elections that I just mentioned?
I think the interesting note in terms of the elections that you mentioned is this question about the difference in quality in terms of the said elections. So, for example, if we look at the recent elections in the DRC, these elections were really characterized by a lot of chaos in terms of how the elections were organized, a lot of frustration in terms of how the Electoral Commission run the elections, but also a lot of challenges in terms of questions about the future of the democratic experiment in the DRC. However, on the other hand, we did see peaceful handover of power in terms of George Weah losing power in Liberia and graciously accepting his defeat. We did see a contentious element in terms of the elections in Zimbabwe, where, of course, the opposition complained about the Mnangagwa administration not creating an open play field for all the people to be able to vote peacefully, particularly from the opposition. So I really think it's a patchwork in terms of the review for the year. Some elections better than others. But I really think 2024 raises a lot more questions about whether Africa will continue on the path of democratization, or will we see some of the challenges that we saw with democratic backsliding, particularly within the Sahel belt, where different regimes chose to come to power through extra constitutional means in countries like Mali, Guinea, and other countries within the Sahel.
And we'll get to some of those. And Michael Walsh, I just want to add on to what the Prof just said earlier. On the other hand, there were positive developments, of course. President Macky Sall in Senegal announcing he won't stand for a third term ahead of elections there next month. And in Liberia, as the Prof mentioned, President George Weah quickly conceding defeat to Joseph Boakai, who is set to take office later this month. Now, there were questions from political commentators, from observers, for a while now about whether democracy is dying, not just in Africa, but around the world. If you take a look back at the sort of big picture, including the coups that we've seen, what does that picture tell you about the state of democracy on the continent?
I mean, I think the democracy summit itself tells us a lot about the state of democracy. I mean, we had Niger being lifted up on a stage as an example of democracy, and now look at where we are today with Niger. So I think that, you know, there's a lot of concern about the trajectory that Africa is on with respect to democracy, but there's also some positive signs. I mean, the participation rates still remain quite high. And so, you know, I think there's a desire for democracy on the continent. We see that. I mean, we see that in many places. I mean, South Africa is one of the examples where people are questioning whether or not democracy is the right form of government. But in other places across the continent, especially places that don't have democracy, there is a demand for democracy in some of those places. And so I think this gap between representation and participation, the gap between expectations and, you know, what's actually delivered, I think that's really where the challenge is with the trajectory that we're on.
And that determines how people perceive democratic government and whether it really does deliver for them. Johanna, 2023 also marked the departure of French troops from West Africa. France's footprint in its former colonies diminished. At the same time, we saw the influence and footprint of other powers expanding on the continent, China, Russia, for example. But now, in the case of Francophone countries, in your view, is the answer when it comes to a power like France, is the answer to change the nature of the relationship with France or be done with a former colonial power, no matter what?
Well, first of all, we have to look at, you know, why are these coups taking place in those countries, right? We have to look at the role that France has played in the underdevelopment of some of these countries and the extracting some of the resources out of those countries where those countries cannot develop, right? So I think that we have to take a step back and really analyze the situation. We look at these countries, their currency is backed by the franc, right? And I think people are just tired of it. And people are ready for a new form of government, a new form of alliances and partnership. It also speaks to U.S. foreign policy towards those countries in the Sahel region. In some regard, the U.S. has indeed failed. And I think that with all of these various coups taking place, it is an opportunity for the United States to stand up and redraft and re-strategize its policy towards those countries to ensure economic prosperity, not just providing humanitarian assistance, because as we have seen it, humanitarian assistance is just not working. I mean, those countries, in spite of their vast resources, but they're still some of the poorest countries in the world. Why is that? It is unacceptable. And I think those leaders and the people in those countries are just fed up and they want their kids to have a better and brighter future. So therefore, they want a new government.
Professor David Monda, I've read how close ties to France could be, quote, a kiss of death for African governments in this region, in West Africa particularly. How should Western countries navigate the sort of what seems to be an allergic reaction from some African countries to the presence, military or otherwise, in their countries of former colonial powers?
I think in terms of Africa, context is key. So when we think about Francophone Africa, France has developed a very special and different relationship with its former colonies than, say, the English or the Anglophone world or the Lusophone world, for that matter. So when we're thinking of France, for example, you mentioned a lot of the antipathy within the Sahel and within a lot of former French colonies towards France. So this really begs the question about whether La Francophonie, right, this special relationship that de Gaulle had established with post-colonial Francophone leaders is still salient. And it really looks that is really being challenged. And I think, obviously, individual country contexts are very different. Senegal is very different, for example, from the DRC. The Congo, Republic of Congo is very different from Niger, basically in terms of the political composition, democratic institutions, and so on and so forth. But particularly in those countries, within the Sahel in particular, the Guineas, the Burkina Fasos, the Nigers, the Chads that have really been rooting to kick off the French, I think they're really in a tenuous space because France has such a deep control of a lot of their political and economic institutions. So those countries will really have to navigate a very close balance around decoupling from previous tenets and legacies of French colonial control, but still maintaining a friendly interface with the West, particularly in terms of stabilizing their economies and also in terms of national security questions and defense issues.
Michael, talking about, you know, we've been talking about the future of democracy in places like Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger. The leaders there who have come to power through, non-democratic means have promised a return to democracy, I guess, at some point, but they've delayed elections and referendums. How can one expect a return to democracy if those promising a return to democracy did not come to power through democratic means? I mean, hasn't a precedent now been set that, hey, look, if you're not happy with civilian rule, there's always the option of a power grab?
I mean, that's been the concern for a long time, not just in Africa, but around the world, you know, that when you have coups, it sets into motion, you know, a changing of the expectations of society as to how you have regime change. And, you know, in the case of some of the Sahel countries, you also have, you know, governments getting into bed with private military contractors and others who don't necessarily have a commitment to democracy either. And so when you start to get the, you know, sort of system behind, you know, maintaining power and staying in power in place, it's hard to see how you're going to follow through on the commitment to democracy. But that's not to say that it can't happen. And so ultimately, it's going to come down to the leadership in these countries to make a decision as to what they want to do. And I think this incentivization that's trying to happen in this regional conversation, you see Morocco. You know, Morocco is coming down and they're trying to play a role in the Sahel. And so I think you're seeing a collapse now between North Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa, and the Sahel is at the intersection of that. And I think that could play a constructive role. So it would be interesting to see what happens, but I think, you know, there's not necessarily all the pessimism there, because there is an opportunity now for some other countries to exert some regional leadership and maybe try to find a solution out of this.
I want you just to stay with me, Johan. I'm going to come to you after the break. We have to take a break very quickly, but we will continue our discussion after that as we look back at 2023, including the wars and major summits that changed the geopolitical landscape. How did those events shape relations between the U.S. and major African partners? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Decades of clashes between armed groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo have led to widespread violations of human rights and devastating incidents of gender-based violence. Up to 6.1 million people are internally displaced and often vulnerable to exploitation and abuse. In this week's special edition of Our Voices, we will take a look at the alarming situation of refugees through a VOA documentary, The Silent War, produced by Omari Kaseko. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We'll bring you the latest in...
You're with Straight Talk Africa. Welcome back. We're discussing the people and the politics that shaped the news in 2023, as well as the stories likely to impact the geopolitical landscape in 2024. My guests here in studio are Johanna LeBlanc. She is a legal and foreign policy analyst and partner at the Washington-based Adomi Advisory Group. Also with us, Michael Walsh. She's a political commentator and senior fellow in the Africa program at the Foreign Policy Research Institute. And joining us remotely from Johannesburg, South Africa, is David Monda, a political analyst and professor of politics at City University of New York. Johanna, I want to pick up things here with you and turn to the situation in Haiti. The UN greenlighting plans to send a multinational force to that country to help quell the violence there. But it was Kenya's President William Ruto really grabbed the headlines with his offer to send Kenyan police as part of that contingent. Should these plans go ahead, will this be the so-called new chapter that the UN chief hopes it will be?
Well, the Republic of Haiti just celebrated its 220th year of independence, the first black independent country in the world, which gained its independence through a bloody revolution with France. To understand where Haiti is currently, you have to go back to 1804. And even after the country gained its independence, it was not recognized by the United States for 60 years. And in addition to that, Haiti had to pay Haiti had to pay to France over $20 billion for gaining its independence. So when you look at the United States and Haiti, which are the two oldest republics in the Western Hemisphere, America has enjoyed a very flourished democracy, whereas Haiti, on the other hand, has dealt with a number of political instability over the course of decades, and today, modern day insecurity. Now, while I applaud President Ruto's commitment to helping to address the insecurity challenges in Haiti, because I think it shows Pan-Africanism, it shows that black nations can work with each other to address some of their unique challenges, but I'm gravely concerned, and the reason why is because the insecurity challenge that we're seeing in Haiti, it's man-made. So if there's political will, some of those issues could be addressed. So for example, the weapons that are all across Haiti. Now, right now, we have about 80% of the country has been controlled by gangs, in particular, Port-au-Prince. Haiti does not manufacture weapons. We know the source of those weapons. They're coming from South Florida and other places across the region. So the U.S. needs to have a robust policy to stop those guns from entering into the country. That's the first step. Secondly, the United States also needs to look at some of the actors who are funding and financing some of these gangs. Because the reality is that imposing mere visa sanctions are not sufficient. We need to restrict those individuals' access to the financial markets in the United States and across the world. We saw recently the UN has just released a report showing that former president of Haiti, Michel Martelly, has actually financed gangs to contribute to the insecurity challenges. So while I think President Ruto really wants to work with the Haitian people and the Haitian government, which right now really is not a Haitian government because the country has not had elections right in years, but unless the United States is committed to addressing the root cause of the issues, it's going to be a waste of time. And we can't We also cannot overlook the role that U.S. foreign policy has played in the underdevelopment of the Haitian state. The intervention from 1915 until 1934, which was disastrous, and so on. So I think President Ruto has a great, he's committed, but we have to address the root cause of these problems first.
So thanks for the help, but we're going to need more than that. Unfortunately, all the other problems we're going to talk about here are man-made. Michael, I do not even know where to start in the dramatic series of events that have happened in the U.S.-South Africa relationship in 2023. Of course, it's about war, who's waging those wars, and the International Criminal Court. South Africa was not willing to turn over Sudan's Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. Pretoria was willing to quit the ICC over the arrest warrant it issued to Vladimir Putin, and now it's turning to the ICC to file a case of genocide against Israel over its war in Gaza. What is South Africa hoping to accomplish here?
So it has multiple sort of parallel paths it's going down. So one is the ICC, the other is ICJ. So there's two separate courts that they're moving forward to. The ICC case was filed as a group of five countries. The ICJ is just on their own. They went out and they filed this. And so what they're trying to do, I think, is to, first of all, in their minds, to hold accountable Israel for what they see to be war crimes. And so I do think there's an honest, sincere belief amongst the leadership in South Africa that there is something to be held accountable for here. And that's going to put sort of South Africa on a collision course with countries that are partners and allies of Israel in the conflict that's happening right now. So that's one part of it. Another part gets back to this historical context that you're talking about. You know, South Africa was on the receiving end of criticism for its own unwillingness to follow the path that was set forward for it with respect to arrest warrants for people who fell on the other side of the Western Divide. And so they pushed back on that, and they said, look, we're not going to arrest Bashir. We're not going to arrest Putin. They said it would be a declaration of war to do that. So they see a hypocrisy in the entire international system around war crimes and around war and around international humanitarian law. So this provides a great opportunity to highlight that. And so I think they are highlighting it. I don't think that, you know, if you look back on history, I mean, Russia didn't abide by an ICJ call for them to cease hostilities. I don't think they expect Israel to either. But it provides an opportunity for them to stand on the world stage and to make a point. And it's a point that, you know, South Africans, you know, for the, especially the leadership in the ANC, has been strongly in support of for a long time. The Palestinian cause is a huge cause for them.
Professor, and guys, we have to move a little faster here now from here on. But Professor, there are crucial elections coming up in South Africa, the economy reeling there from high unemployment and electricity crisis. How does all of this on the international stage help Cyril Ramaphosa at home? Should he be busy with this or with domestic matters?
I think yes, should be busy with both. Just before our interview today, you know, I was a little concerned whether there might be load shedding in my area and I might not be able to speak with you. So there's major domestic concerns, particularly around energy, particularly around the South African economy that's been slow, lethargic. On the question of migration, there's a big problem here with a large percentage of undocumented immigrants, in particular from sub-Saharan Africa. So Ramaphosa is really at this very tenuous base where the domestic policy in turn affects the foreign policy, and the foreign policy would tend to affect the domestic policy. By that I mean there's a lot of division within the ANC. The former President Zuma has vowed not to support the ANC. The population, by and large, several opinion polls have showed that many South Africans are very concerned about state capture. So he has a lot of domestic problems. Power problems continue. But I think in terms of the foreign policy issues that we spoke about, he also has this dilemma where South Africa post-apartheid really became this bastion of the global conscience in the Mandela era. And he has to speak very forcefully around questions around the Palestinian issue, around marginalization of the global south more broadly. Mm-hmm. But as much as he does that, as much as he highlights contradictions in the international criminal justice system around leaders in the West not being held to account, but those in the global south being charged at the ICC, Ramaphosa to be very careful because South African economy is very much tied with major Western powers. And here we're thinking the EU and the US in particular. So I think he really has to balance his political gymnastics around consolidating his power locally, but also ensuring that he maintains his allies in the West, but also speaks very forcefully around those philosophical issues that South Africa has historically been very vocal about.
And, you know, I wanted to get to AGOA, I wanted to get to the G20. We probably won't be able to get to all of that. But, you know, I want to talk to all three of you, and I'm going to start with you, Johanna. What will be the stories you think in 2024 that will shape the news, will shape the headlines? Who are the people, and what are the stories that you're looking out for?
Well, we can't forget former President Donald Trump. He's definitely going to dominate the news this time, this 2024. It is a presidential election year. We saw the Colorado Supreme Court made a ruling, unprecedented, that he's not eligible to appear on the ballot. And I think the United States Supreme Court is going to be forced to look at that ruling and make a decision. So there's that. And I think also AGOA is going to be a topic of discussion because many countries across the African continent benefit from it. And we're also going to look at the upcoming elections in places like Ghana, South Africa, obviously, and other places. So,
Michael Walsh, you've got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, for me, South Africa elections is a big one. The role of Morocco in the continent and North Africa as a whole in the continent. And then I think this whole Menendez thing is a big deal with Egypt and what the relationship with the U.S. and Egypt is going to be as a consequence of that.
Well, I'll be looking out for the crucial elections in Senegal. Professor David Mondo, sorry we couldn't get to you for this one, but, you know, we have you on the show to come talk to us about 2024. I do want to thank all of you for being with us, Johanna LeBlanc, Michael Walsh, and Professor David Mondo. Thank you. And with 2023 now in the rearview mirror, we look forward to a new year. Thank you for being with us, and I hope you'll join us every week here on Straight Talk Africa in the year to come. Thanks to all my guests and the more than 300 affiliate TV and radio stations carrying the show across the African continent. We leave you with some of the most striking images from 2023, the segment produced by Karina Chowdhury. We wish you a happy and prosperous 2024. Goodbye.